This episode is sponsored by The Bridge to Recovery, a nonprofit program on 115 acres near Bowling Green, Kentucky, a tranquil place where they've been changing lives for over 40 years. Their people improve their quality of life by acknowledging past emotional wounds and healing from all forms of trauma. The CEO, Paul Hamlin, has been a friend of mine for 20 years. Call him directly at 858-945-7848. That's 858-945-7848, or you can learn more about The Bridge to Recovery by clicking the link in the show notes or visiting thebridgetorecovery.com. Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of this show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
I'm Eric Bricker, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
I'm Tom Gentry. Thanks for listening. This episode features a friend of mine named Eric Bricker. Eric is a licensed mental health counselor who specializes in grief, loss, sorrow, as well as addiction, which is how he and I cross paths. And, you know, if you've listened to this and you've heard me talk about my story as it relates to my own recovery from alcoholism, you know, one of the things that's difficult, I think, for people who are entering recovery is that, you know, there's this feeling that you're not normal. You know, there's a tremendous amount of shame that comes with the behavior that people engage in active addiction. And you tend to hurt the people you love. And so there's a lot of shame. And, you know, it's kind of hard to feel normal. You feel like you're part of this subculture all of a sudden that doesn't necessarily always feel great. So, you know, back in the very beginning of my career in the addiction treatment industry, I met Eric. He was a young counselor who, you know, had a late night on Friday nights. You know, he worked Monday through Friday, worked late on Friday night. And I was a young behavioral technician or counselor's assistant, is what it's called a lot of times now, who worked Thursday and Friday nights and Saturday, Sunday days, 4 10-hour shifts. So I was there late on Friday evenings at the same time as Eric, and a lot of times we would have dinner together, and we got to talking and became friends. And, you know, eventually he became a mentor to me, did my clinical supervision for my counseling certification. So we've stayed in each other's lives all these years, you know, about 21 years now. But you know what was great for me about becoming friends with Eric in the beginning is, I mean, he was a counselor in substance abuse treatment, but he wasn't someone who suffers with the disease. He's what, you know, a lot of us might call a normie. And, you know, we related. We got along really well and liked each other and became friends. And he treated me like a normal person, which meant a lot to me. You know, just to feel like a normal kid again. You know, I was 25 years old. So, you know, Eric's been great to me over the years. He's been very supportive of me and my career in many different ways and has just given me a lot of encouragement over the years. So, you know, the reason I wanted to talk to a therapist who specializes in grief, because I think one of the things that can get in our way from being our authentic selves is not experiencing sorrow the way that we need to. You know, not experiencing grief and loss and avoiding all that, or maybe kind of bypassing it. You know, a lot of people, they lose someone, they don't want to talk about it. Other people are afraid to talk to them about it. So it just has huge implications as it relates to us as human beings and whether or not we flourish. So anyway, I really enjoyed having him here, and I hope you enjoy the conversation too. So here you go, Eric Bricker. How you doing, Eric?
Not bad, man. Not bad. I feel pretty good today.
Yeah, I'm happy to have you here.
I'm excited to be here, man. This is really cool to see what you're up to and your whole studio and everything. I like it.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a little bit of a stretch to call it a studio, but I've kind of made do. I'm pretty happy with it, you know. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, we go back a really long way, and, you know, we were talking a little bit before, and, you know, you wanted to kind of touch on this theme of being on the right path, and you have a story you were going to tell?
Absolutely. I love telling the story. Who doesn't love a good story, you know?
That's what this is all about, man. That's, you know, that's kind of the point of all this, because, you know, I've started calling this podcast the opposite of small talk.
Yeah.
Because small talk just kind of makes me want to throw up. I mean, I have a really hard, and I think you and I, we've been friends for so long. I think we're both similar in this way. Like, I don't have a lot of use for small talk, and I'm pretty easy to read that way, I think. So if I'm in a room full of people who I don't really want to talk to, it's probably pretty obvious, but you know, if we have a chance to sit down like this for an hour and I get to hear your life story, I'm totally into that. And just the world these days, the way we function in this whole text message, watered down sort of way. I mean, I know I'm starved for stuff like this, you know, I mean, I'm the guy who still writes handwritten letters to people and stuff like that. And so, yeah, I like depth. And so, yeah, I got off course a little bit here, but I do love a good story. So let's hear it.
Okay. So I was working for the Seminole Tribe, and I was with them for about 10 years. And while I was there, I was the administrator of the Youth Drug Prevention Program. And I had the really good fortune to connect with the guy. We worked together a lot, the fellow who was the director of the Boys and Girls Club there. His name is Robert North, Robert Cloud North. And he was a really pretty amazing guy. He's native. He's really steeped in culture, tradition. He's, you know, definitely guided by faith and just positive things, you know, a driven individual. And I was also a really good drummer, you know, and his son, Robert Cloud North Jr., we call him RC. I don't think we can call him that anymore. I think he's kind of shed the kid name. But so now it's just Robert Cloud and Robert Cloud Music. And so he's a singer-songwriter, and he's phenomenal. He's just like an unbelievable talent, like brilliant Robert Jr. And I had the good fortune of being able to play music with them, and we got together and we kind of did youth prevention program stuff with the music. Mm-hmm. And so we were kind of the backup band for all of these young kids that would come and want to play. And then we put on these talent shows for the community, and it provided the kids with a really amazing opportunity to showcase their talent, to be seen by their families doing something positive. And so even if, and it became like a fun challenge for us musically, because even if you had a kid that came along and could play the three chords for Sweet Home Alabama, that's all we needed. We could provide you with a backup band, vocals, guitar solo, drum. We can make you play that song on stage, and it's all you needed was just the willingness to practice with us a few times, and we're going to make it into a song. So it was almost like our own challenge, and we loved mm-hmm. it. And in the process of that, I got to learn some of Robert's, his original work, and we developed like bass tracks to them.
Mm-hmm. So and, you're a bassist.
Yeah, I'm a bass player. And so, you know, we performed at some of the community events and sort of toured around the reservation, and it was a really fun thing. And I got access to certain situations that normally aren't accessible to people who are not tribal. You know, we played in some of the villages on Tamiami Trail, where people kind of lived more, you know, where it's kind of like
traditionally.
Where people live more traditionally. It's a little more insular. You know, the Miccosukee is there. So the folks on trail are some of the more traditional folks. And I got to play over there and meet some of those people. And it was really, it was just like a really cool experience. And we actually played at the Gathering of Nations out in, New Mexico. It's this big, powwow where tribes from all over the country are kind of represented, and there's like thousands of people there. So it was really, really an amazing experience. It took me further than I ever thought I would go, and musically was the greatest experience I've ever had musically, by playing. And so after I left the tribe, you know, to take another job to kind of move forward, you sort of put those things behind you. And I had a really bad habit of sort of sealing off the past. When I move into a new situation, I oftentimes will let relationships lapse. I'll let experiences lapse. You know, I'm just kind of focused on what I'm doing next and don't always take a time to appreciate where I've been, what I've done, what was meaningful to me. And in one of the things that happened was the tribe came out with this commemorative book. It was the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Seminole Tribal Constitution that got them federally recognized. It was a really big deal, and it was celebrated, and it was this really cool kind of gold collectible book. And my name was in there with the band, and there weren't a lot of non-tribal people whose names got to be in that book. It was a prized possession. And somewhere along the way, when I was moving from one office to another, I lost the book. I misplaced it. And it really bothered me that this book was gone. You know, all of a sudden, all these years later, it bothers me that I don't have this book. So I started hunting it down, and I found a copy on Amazon somewhere, and, you know, bought the copy, and I got my book back, and I found a little page with my name on it and all this. And I'm sort of like really excited about that. And 5 days later, Robert North, the dad, direct messages me on Facebook because we've been friends and I follow mm-hmm. Robert's music and the thing, his projects and things over the years, direct messages me and he says, do you want to get together with me and Robert Jr.? Like, do you want to get together and hang out a little bit and, you know, kind of visit with us and maybe have something of a reunion? And I'm like, oh, I absolutely want to do that. And so we went, we met up, we got to talking, and now all of a sudden we have these plans to start rehearsing. And I've got a spot in Boca that's perfect, like a music studio, someone I know who owns a place where we can rehearse and record if we want to and practice. And there's a stage there. It's just like perfect. So, you know, they come up, we meet up together and, you know, we had our first practice. It was like fantastic. So at some point in all of this, I said, you know, Robert, this is crazy. Like, I just got my book back 5 days ago and here we are. I said, that's just, you know, it's kind of an amazing sort of put it out there into the universe and it will be delivered to you. And he looks at me and he goes, well, to us, that just means you're walking the right path and that your heart is good. You know, and I stopped and thought about that and I'm like, wow, that's definitely whatever I need to do to assimilate that into my consciousness on a daily basis, so that becomes part of my belief system spiritually, I need to put a lot of energy into that, because that was an important moment from someone who I experienced as being very spiritually fit and grounded, who like gave me that pearl of wisdom to kind of, you know, to really bring this whole experience together and what and how to interpret it and what it should mean to me spiritually. So, and I'm learning to pay attention to those things, and I'm learning to believe into them, and I'm learning to allow them to bring good things to my life. And that to me is really part of how we create our own happiness, mm-hmm. you know? And so in my work with other people, it's that belief system that guides me. It's really, I think, the gift that I was given that I'm trying to give to other people. Mm-hmm. And then there's a technical aspect of how you can actually help people find that in themselves. And that's really like the greater mission, you know,
to help them find their path.
Yeah. To help them find their path, and to believe that in spite of everything that's happened, your heart is good.
Yeah.
And you are on the right path. Choose to see it. Choose to see it. Choose to look around you and see all of the reminders that you are actually on the right path and that your heart is good. And sometimes you have to look really, really hard to yeah. see that, because there's a lot of other things that we could be paying attention to.
Yeah.
That are not good.
Yeah.
And that we don't like.
Yeah. And, you know, what we give our attention, we magnify, you know, but this ties in obviously really well with the podcast, The Path to Authenticity. And, you know, for me, you know, I chose the word path very intentionally. And if you look at my logo, I think I've probably talked to you about this, but I haven't talked about it on the podcast, but it's a little labyrinth. And, which for those of you who don't know, it's a spiritual meditative practice to walk a labyrinth. And I was kind of at a turning point in my career a few, I guess going back like 10 years ago now, and kind of trying to figure out, I was really kind of sideways trying to figure out what I needed to do. I needed to make a change. And I was at a men's retreat at this place, and they had two labyrinths, which I had always kind of scoffed at before, you know, like, oh, you're walking a maze, big deal, you know. But I set aside my prejudice and I walked it. And, you know, I don't know if you've ever walked a labyrinth before, have you?
No,
yeah.
No, I have not.
Well, you know, it's something happens. You know, you go through all these twists and turns. You know, it's you're literally following a path to the center, and it symbolizes the totality of life. And in the center is supposedly God. You know, that's what it symbolizes, the center. But something happens in your brain when you're making all these turns, and you kind of do go into a little bit of a trance-like state. And a lot of times people go in there with an intention or a question, and mine was, you know, what do I do? What am I going to do with this crossroads I've reached in my life? And the answer I got was stay on the path. Stay on the path that you're on. And so, so I've ever since then when it came time to get another job, I went and interviewed at a place and they're showing me around this facility, and they start mentioning this labyrinth. I'm like, oh, and I asked them, will you take me? And it was, you know, a few acres away from where we were, but they walked me up this big hill to show me this labyrinth. And it was the same type of labyrinth with the same materials that, you know, and it was like, I knew this was where I was supposed to be. So it's been a strong thing for me, and important to me ever since then. And the labyrinth has become kind of like my special place. But okay, so you mentioned the work that you do with people. You're a licensed mental health counselor. And one of the reasons we're going to talk today is because you right now at this point in your career, which has spanned how long at this point?
More than 20 years.
Yeah. now you've come to specialize in grief and loss. I've had a lot of training around that. And, you know, I want to mention one other thing that you and I were having a conversation the other day, where, you know, we've both worked in addiction treatment over the years, and you made a comment about how, as this therapist who's been around and had the experience that you have, that you really have a need to connect with younger guys like the techs who are working at these facilities and kind of take them under your wing. And I was like, yeah, remember? I was one of those guys, you know? And so when you say your career goes back 20 years, I mean, I think your career maybe started 3 or 4 years before mine.
Sure.
And you were a counselor at this Hazelden facility who happened to work on Friday nights. And my job was Thursday, Friday night, Saturday, Sunday day. And you took me under your wing, and we ended up having dinner every Friday night. And you've really been, you know, if I look at, I've been in Florida for 23 years now. So if I look at that part of my life, you have been the oldest, most consistent, truest friend that I've had, that I've built down here. And you've helped me a lot over the years. So it's really cool to have you here. So, you know, one of the things that I wanted to bring up in relation to grief that I think is that we don't always pay enough attention to is, you know, I know for me, at some point, I had to mourn the loss of what might have been.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's interesting. I'm doing some work right now with a woman by the name of Beverly Buncher, and she's really cool. She has a family recovery program where she works with the family members of people with substance use disorders, and she helps them with their recovery as family members. And she operationalized this system called the BALM. She calls it BALM, Be a Loving Mirror, is what that means. And we got together, and I taught, you know, because I've known her over the years, and I've actually presented to her her clients, and we talk a lot about grief, you know, and she liked the topic, and we've decided to do an 8-part series with her folks. That actually starts tonight. And so we call it Grieving the Loss of the Dream, because in substance use disorder, in addiction, there's losses where people actually pass away and die. And that's part of it. That's a terrible and tragic thing. And it's only escalating worse with the number of overdoses over the last 10 years as the opiate epidemic has really proliferated into an epidemic. Mm-hmm. But we also talk about this other thing, which is the loss of the dream. And so what you're talking about, what we're grieving, is often the loss of the dream, because like the actual substance abuser themselves, the family has lost a dream. And if we don't get past that, if we don't learn to reconceptualize our relationship to self and our relationship to the person and our relationship to time, opportunity, if we don't learn gratitude, what happens is it's really easy to get stuck into, he was the valedictorian of his high school and a varsity athlete. Is it still possible for him to go pro? You know, is it still possible for him to go to an Ivy League school? Is it, you know, because I'm still stuck back in what he could have been. And at 35 years old, we've got to move on.
Right.
We've got to move on to the reality of today and not the reality of 15 years ago. And that's what's so hard for people to let go of. Family members and recovering people themselves. Because we don't get to parent the children that we want. We get to parent the children that we have. And oftentimes we can't go backwards and live the life we wanted. We have to live the life we have now.
Right.
And so there's so much a part of that. Yeah. But so anyway, that the loss of the green, I actually think in some ways recovery is in a sense a grief and loss issue because, or partly a grief and loss mm-hmm. issue, because everyone who is getting sober is actually grieving the loss of the alcohol and drugs.
Right.
First off, I mean, that is a relationship.
Right.
That is a relationship. I mean, when you think about the consistent engagement, you think about, hey, I spent more time doing that than I spent with anyone I ever loved in my, you know what
right.
I mean?
Right.
So if you think about that, it is a relationship and it has to be grieved. And the lifestyle is grieved because we have to kind of reconceptualize what life is, and we have to, you know, become comfortable with a new reality. And mm-hmm. that's what grieving people, that's what they're doing. It's about allowing ourselves to move through a process, not to get to an end of it, to move through it and to be in it so that we can, you know, live mm-hmm. life differently.
Well, and you know, you mentioned that the substance in the substance abuse, it is a relationship. And, you know, I think what makes it even more significant is that it's a soothing relationship.
Sure.
You know, so it's something that, you know, people turn to as a method of navigating their pain and suffering. And so when it's a coping skill that eventually stops working anyway, and it starts having the opposite effect, destroying your life rather than helping you get through it. But it's still, you know, there's still this suffering that exists that we have to figure out a way to manage somehow. And I know for me, there was a lot of grief and loss underneath all that, which is why I, you know, had the kind of relationship with alcohol that I had in the first place. You know, I didn't realize it at the time, but looking back, I know that there were things I needed to mourn that I wasn't mourning.
Of course. I think it's very much a connection issue. You know, I think substance use disorder is very much a connection issue because when you take the substances away and people are trying to figure out what comes next, what do I do with myself? There's often the greatest difficulties that everyone has is how do I deal with people? How do I manage how I feel? How do I manage criticism? How do I manage my loneliness and anxiety and all these existential angsts of who I am and feeling alone and scared in the world? And that's all connection. That's all loneliness and it's all grief. It's all because when we have this, you know, anesthesia that can medicate all of those things, we can convince ourselves that all of that doesn't exist. And then, you know, there's the other stuff to it, Tom. Like you talk about, you get sober and you realized how bereaved you actually are. Mm-hmm. So now in the wake of the opioid epidemic with so many people overdosing and dying, these people that have already passed away are the peers and family members of our patients.
Right.
You know, so you get people who are getting into sobriety and they'll turn around and they'll tell you, you know, I lost 5 people in the last year.
Right.
Like people who were my friends, like people I grew up with who OD'd and died.
Right.
Or even things that are more tragic when there's a sense of personal responsibility or guilt involved.
Right.
When they said, you know, my girlfriend OD'd and died last year and 5 years ago I shot her up for the first time.
Right.
And now I'm dealing with that tremendous guilt and shame that I am a horrible person and really not deserving of a
right.
life worth living in sobriety.
Right. And survivor's guilt, just why, you know, it should have been me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's alarming to me how often we see stuff like that now. And, you know, having, you know, gone through that myself, like, 23 years ago, you know, you just didn't see that stuff very often. And now, I mean, if you were doing a group with 5 or 6 guys, there are probably at least two of them who have gone through something like that. And most of them have lost someone to an overdose. You know, it's so pervasive in our culture too. I mean, which to me goes to, you know, in spite of the substances, in spite of the pharmaceutical industry and what they've done wrong and how it's all been regulated and you know, the insurance industry, it's, you know, aside from all that, we're off track as a culture. Like there's, from a meaning standpoint, like to me, I wish more of us were taking a look at, like, what are we doing when this many people are dying because, you know, they're using some life-threatening method of managing their suffering? You know, what is it? What do we need to do differently as a society or a culture that, you know, to me, that's the real question. Like, why are we here in the first place? So, yeah, it's sad. It really is. So at what point did you start to really dig deep into the grief stuff and get specialized training for that? And what made you decide to do that?
So that started initially when I was working for the Seminole Tribe. It's a culture of people that is profoundly impacted by grief and loss. There's a lot of tragedy there. There's intergenerational trauma that exists within the tribe. You know, they are victim of genocide, really. Right. I mean, you know, Indian removal was not about removing them from where they were living and relocating them to reservations. Indian removal was about wiping these people from the face of the earth so that their land could be stolen from them. Right. I mean, that's what that was. And it's sort of like in some ways still going on. I mean, if you look at what's going on at Standing Rock, it's still going on. You know, it's still going on. It's a rural community of people. It's a rural reservation. And they want to run this pipeline through their only water source.
Right.
And that's fresh water and clean water for children. I mean, that's the water that sustains the tribe.
Right.
If that gets poisoned, the community dies.
Right.
That's what they're fighting for their lives, you know, and people don't, you know, and they're like, yeah, but we got money to make, and they can hire, and they hire private security firms. Right. With attack dogs and things that are, you know, attacking these people because they're trying to disrupt the construction of this pipeline. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, how do you get away with that stuff? Like, yeah. Why is nobody from our government advocating for the rights of these people to sort of like stand their ground? I don't know. It's so upsetting.
And the point of the intergenerational trauma and the fact that it's still going on, I mean, just every single one of these little things that comes up day to day with Native people just triggers that trauma all over again that's been passed down to them, you know, for generations at this point, you know?
Yeah, it's terrible. Yeah, so anyway, that was when I really started to explore it. I actually did the certified grief and loss recovery specialist training while I was working for the tribe in hope of doing some of that work there, and became profoundly impacted by the number of losses that they experienced, you know, that sort of tragedy was a part of their story. Mm-hmm. as I saw it from my vantage point. Again, I was working for the family, you know, the social services program, family services. So the people I was dealing with were the people who had the problems.
Right.
There were also all of these other huge community of people that were doing great and
right.
living great lives. You know, so my more narrow sampling, the people I was there to help that I, you know, was involved with were the ones who were suffering, but I saw a lot of suffering. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, so that was really an attempt to kind of bring that there. And so it always been part of my work and work in treatment and work in private practice as well, the grief and loss. And a couple of years ago, I went to work for the Karen Renaissance. And because I had that background, I was asked to do specifically their grief and loss specialty group. And we just saw the numbers were escalating, you know, of people who had been profoundly impacted by grief and loss. And a lot of it was because of the overdose epidemic. So there were all these patients that we were treating who had lost boyfriends, girlfriends, friends, peers, family members to overdose, and in early sobriety were being just profoundly impacted by these losses, to where it almost like at an intolerable level, because now the anesthesia is gone. There's no drugs and alcohol to medicate all of that pain. And to sit with that, to sit in that, and to experience it at this kind of visceral internal level when you're already in this like fragile space of early sobriety was not tolerable.
Yeah.
And so that was the work that we were doing, you know, a lot of grounding work and a lot of grief recovery work to start moving forward and integrate grief recovery into sobriety. And I learned also to utilize other therapeutic tools. You know, I got trained in EMDR, and I was trained in reconsolidation of traumatic memories. So as we're doing this grief work, you can also incorporate these sort of trauma-based therapies to help people move through these experiences. So for me, it evolved through my own exposure to it, and then just developing other skills and things to help people manage these issues and to move into recovery from them. And I look at it and it feels right. You know, it feels right for me. It feels like the work I want to be doing. It's high level work. It's hard work. And it's because if you look at, like you said, us being out of balance as a culture, as a people, mass shootings and all these tragedies, you know, everyone's being affected by grief. Everyone's being affected by trauma. It's everywhere you go. So I want to put myself in the middle of all of that, and I want to be of service. I want to be useful. It's funny that we're talking about that. I actually, I've been corresponding with the Red Cross, and I'm going to, volunteer some of my time. They have volunteer disaster response, mental health disaster response team members. And, I'm going to be starting to do that soon, I think.
That's great. Yeah. You know, one of the things I've learned for myself is, at least for me to really heal from this stuff, I have to feel it. And, you know, for a person to really be willing to do that kind of work, I mean, it's hard. It's hard work, and not a lot of people are really willing to do that kind of work unless they're in such crisis that they don't even have a choice a lot of times. But, another way I think we're really off track as a culture is that, we're kind of groomed to avoid these kinds of feelings. And we have just one distraction after another to distract us from our feelings, whether it be, you know, how we spend our money or TV, or, I mean, now all of us carry a computer, supercomputer around in our hands all the time. We constantly have this stimuli. So at what point do we actually just kind of stop and feel and just get grounded in ourselves? And then what happens to us when we do? I think a lot of people really have a hard time with that, you know, silence. What do you do if you have 3 minutes of silence and you don't have a way to distract yourself? You have to feel, you know?
There's a woman by the name of Feldman. She's a researcher, and she does this really profound research on emotions. Mm-hmm. And really has reconceptualized. I think her work is going to become more and more prominent in mental health because of sort of like the paradigm shift that she discovered, where because we tend to think about emotions as being in response to what's going on. Mm-hmm. I feel sad and scared and angry and guilty over what just happened. But in her research, she found it, these emotions are not really about history. It's actually about what we think is going to happen next. All these fears and anxieties and angers, it's not about what just happened. It's about your interpretation of what happened and what you believe is about to occur. Mm-hmm. That's what creates that high level of emotion. So to your point, if you've experienced trauma and you haven't had an opportunity to process, deal with it, do work on it, and our principal coping mechanism is avoidance and distraction through substances or even phone addiction,
right.
Media addiction. If I have pain and I'm constantly anesthetizing it, there's an intense fear and avoidance of what I'm going to experience if I actually do it. So the grief itself creates its own secondary anxiety,
right.
Because I now have to keep on the hamster wheel. I have to keep doing this because I am living in, whether it's conscious or subconscious, I am living in active avoidance that I am not going to be able to tolerate this. And that's why oftentimes death in our culture, speaking right to it, you know, that death in our culture is often not talked about, you know, because, and often people with grief and loss become tremendously isolated. People around them don't necessarily know how to deal with them. Mm-hmm. And so once you get past that, I'm so sorry. And, if there's anything you need, let me know. We'll do that once. And then maybe it's the next call is, hey, how are you doing, man? You doing good? And then how are you doing? And that's really what most of us get from our friends and family, mm-hmm. because it's uncomfortable to talk about. And people who are grieving have a lot to say about their experience. And really, you know, talking about people who have passed is important. It's actually how we keep their memory alive and how we learn to reconceptualize like the incomplete communication and the loss of the relationship and how we begin to create a new relationship with those people that have passed. Mm-hmm. Because we have to come to some place of acceptance that the relationship with that person as it was is over.
Right.
And that there needs to be a new relationship. And so, you know, part of working with the population is you have to write, you have to say goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
And people really have a tough time with that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think you're right, man. I think we as a culture do not like to tolerate emotion, and there's actually a lot of fear mm-hmm. around that.
Well, and, you know, the irony is that the fact that we avoid it makes it worse. I mean, it's exhausting. It is, you know, it just prolongs any suffering that we're experiencing by delaying it. When, you know, if we just allow ourselves to experience the emotions that are coming up for us, then, you know, we do get back to neutral. And I think we tell ourselves these stories that it's going to like last forever and
it's
going to destroy us, you know?
Well, I think that's what the thing with all of it. Again, you know, like emotion's not about what just happened. It's about what you think is going to happen mm-hmm. next. So if what's in my head is this feeling, I've allowed myself to experience a feeling and it's intolerable. then the belief is going to be, now I'm afraid of what's going to happen next.
Right.
And the belief is, welcome to this new reality, this terrible feeling that you're having. This is what you're going to experience every minute of every day of the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And I don't want it. I don't want to touch it. I don't want to live in this. I need to get out of this. Mm-hmm. What do I have to do to get out of this? And when we become desperate enough, we can make some really poor choices.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was in a workshop a couple years ago out in California or Texas, and the theme of the weekend was trauma and grief and loss. And it was kind of an overview of, you know, the sorts of issues that we run into as practitioners in the substance abuse treatment industry. And there was a guy there, if I remembered his last name, I'd say his full name because he's brilliant, but I don't. But he kind of did this exercise with the people in the audience of, you know, what are you afraid of? And I'm afraid, you know, my dog will die. And then what? And then I'll be alone. Or, you know, and what was interesting to me about it is what he demonstrated to us is invariably whatever your fear is, if you keep digging and you keep asking the questions and you get to the bottom of it, it always gets to the point where it's the fear that I'm going to die and I'm going to die alone. Like invariably, every single time it's this. So when we're crippled by our fears, it's not just like an irrational fear that my dog could die. It's really deep down an existential fear that I'm going to die and I'm going to die alone.
Yeah. I mean, isolation and death, I mean, those are the existential crises. I think we as a species really are the only ones in the animal kingdom that have that complete capacity for self-awareness, where you're actually able to identify yourself as a separate entity from the rest of the species, mm-hmm. and that you are individuated from all of the others. And because of that, we are, and what comes of that is a very clear understanding that mortality is part of the picture and that you will one day die.
Right.
But until that happens, you have to live knowing about your own expiration date, right?
Right.
And death remains yet undefeated,
right.
Despite our efforts to outsmart it. You know, everybody, I haven't met anyone yet who's made it to 120, you know, 110 years old. I suppose there's someone out there.
Who just haven't met them yet.
Yeah. But, so at some point it's coming and we're going to die. And managing that is such a difficult, you know, for us, it's such a difficult thing. Irving Yalom is one of my favorite authors. He's kind of really, you know, he's a modern existential writer and really probably the most in the tradition of Rollo May and Viktor Frankl and all mm-hmm. the great existential writers of the past. And I found out, I was reading one of his books, I found out he was actually, he did his clinical supervision under Rollo May, the guy who wrote the book, The Meaning of Anxiety. Mm-hmm. So he really is very well steeped in existentialism right. in a classic sense from the masters. And, you know, he wrote this book about death anxiety, and the book is actually called Staring at the Sun. And he calls it Staring at the Sun because nobody wants to look at the sun. If you stare at the sun, you'll go blind. So the idea of a conversation or a book about death, it's something that none of us want to do. None of us want to look into the sun because we're afraid of it, and we're afraid to die, and we're afraid to die alone.
You know, you mentioned this. As human beings, that we have this awareness that we are separate entities, which is really interesting to me because, and this came up in the last podcast that came out on Monday, is that, you know, as human beings, we are, you know, like this infinitesimal percentage of the actual life on the planet. I mean, when you look at animals, plants, everything out there. I mean, you know, we're really part of something much bigger. So that separation, which from us we derive so much fear, is really an illusion. It's really not even real. We're really part of something bigger. We just don't perceive it.
That also is another complication of self-awareness, because self-awareness is never a far leap from self-importance. You know, you know what I mean? Yeah, it's never a far leap between I am aware of myself as individuated from the rest of the people, and that must mean I'm special.
Right.
You know
right,
what I mean?
Right.
Like, yeah, you and the rest of you are as special as the – more special than the other 300 billion people. I mean, literally, like, you know – we can't really be the best at anything. You know, there's just too many people.
Yeah.
But we want to be the best.
Well, you know what we can be the best at, though, is being ourselves.
Path to authenticity, right?
That's right.
This is
that's
the
right.
path to authenticity.
It is.
Be that's the message. Be the best at being yourself. Mm-hmm. Start with that.
Yeah.
Start with that.
Yeah, because, you know, the whole idea of, I mean, we might not all be extraordinarily special, but we all do have something unique to offer. It doesn't make us any more or less important than anyone else, but we really trivialize ourselves if we just don't, you know, access that or don't pay attention to that and just kind of conform to whatever is expected of us rather than following our path.
Totally, because even if you can bench 3 plates, you're still going to die at some point. You
yeah.
Know? Yeah. So, you know, just eat the cookie and be cool about it and just have friends and be decent and, you know, try to – I think, too, like the people I know that are the most grounded and all, the people who I've seen that really deal best with adversity and move forward, there's always a sense of purpose mm-hmm. about their lives. There's always meaningfulness. And generally these people, there's a generosity in spirit, right? They're there for others. They show up for others and they participate in the world with others. And they're out there advocating for the betterment of other people. They're out there trying to make things better for other people. And that's, if there's any kind of learning that I've experienced over the years, it's, you want to do good for yourself. Start doing some good for somebody else, you know? Just be thoughtful of other people, man. Show up for people around you, and you'll be surprised. And that's one of the reasons why, like, when I have been working in facilities, I always try to take an interest in, you know, the kids that are working. I call them kids. I'm 50 now. Anyone who's under 30 is
50?
I am. Later this month. Thanks, man. So anyone who's like under 30 is a kid to me. And so, you know, you meet the kid that's a tech or a counselor assistant in a treatment center or something. And I look at that and, a lot of them are in school. They're doing things. You never know who they're going to become or what. But you pay attention to everybody, you know. And if I can be of service, because I'm doing the job that you're going to be doing in a year or 2 years,
right.
Hopefully, you know, if it works out for you, and like I'll help if I can help, if I can be of use, you know, I'll pass something along. I feel obligated to do that.
Yeah.
It's one of the reasons I like to teach.
Yeah.
It's just like a cool opportunity to do that.
Yeah. I feel obligated to do that too. You know, there's certain things that, you know, I'm really good at and I'm driven to offer my assistance to other people in that.
You know, in a sense, I do believe that is one that probably is a huge part of the success of the Alcoholics Anonymous program.
Yeah.
Right. Is that in order to keep what you have to give it away. So mentorship, sponsorship, teaching, giving away knowledge is actually a requirement of your ongoing sobriety.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that people will always be giving will always be giving away brilliance in a generous way to those that need it mm-hmm. and want it. And that's that to me really is the life spring of greatness,
you know, yeah,
and what has created the success of that program.
Yeah, yeah. And it applies to everything. And life. you know, and I mean, there have been times, I mean, well, there are just certain people in my world, you being one of them, who I just like feel so eternally grateful that they've been so generous to me in ways that, you know, I never even necessarily expected. Like another that comes to mind more recently is, you know, I did these two episodes with this guy, John Thomas, who's the publisher of Psychology Today, who I just met at a networking event, and we've become friends. And, you know, he's had this great career in the media, and he's just been super supportive. And, you know, it just, it amazes me. It feels really good when somebody shows up for you, you know, in that way. And, you know, we all need that from other people. And so, you know, I mean, it feels good to give that to other people.
Totally, man.
Yeah.
There's a lot. I think there's a lot in that.
And, you know, this all, you know, we've talked about, I'm really interested in manhood and as boys or men are transitioning to manhood and our concept of what it means to be a man. And, you know, from what I've experienced and what I believe and everything I've read, such an important part of that is being mentored by other men and having positive relationships with men who are senior to us. You know, it's really, really important. And another part of it, which we were just talking about a minute ago, is this, you know, children are supposed to be self-centered, you know, but at some point in life, you know, part of being a man to me is accepting this responsibility of toward my community or the people around me. As a man, I now have a responsibility to support, sustain part, you know, a greater, something greater than myself, something bigger.
Yeah. Can you imagine if everybody in our society had the mindset of, I'm going to contribute one thing I do well to the greater good. I'm going to just give away some, whether it's an hour a week or I'm baking cookies for some, like one thing that I do well, I'm going to just do it and give it away. And everybody in our society was compelled to do that. An hour of my time to teach somebody something, and you know, or to console somebody, whatever it was. If we all did that, what our world would look like, you know?
Yeah.
Like the capital, you know, just the like existential capital of the worth of, right, of what that would be if we actually practiced that.
Yeah.
But, I think we are, if you kind of look around you, we're pretty far from there.
Well, you know, and there's, I know in my life, I've seen a lot of this attitude of what I deserve. You know, yeah. if I'm gonna do this, I deserve to be paid well or whatever. And also, to me, it also comes out in, I wish we were more kind as a culture, you know, especially when it, you know, comes to impoverished people, you know, and this whole, well, he ought to get a job and pull himself up by his bootstraps. And, you know, as we're driving around, I mean, one of the things I've talked to my son about, when we see people panhandling, which we do see in our neck of the woods, you know, I've pointed out to him at times, you know, nobody ever wants to be at that place. It's not a good place to be in life. They're not on a hot streak. And I think most people would much rather work than do something like that. And you know, it's, so I think, you know, just understanding, just being more understanding towards other people and tolerant, yeah, there are a lot of things we could do better, but you know, all we can really do is what we do and do our little part and give where we can. And
one of the things I work on with patients, you know, and work on in my own self is that it's important to practice being compassionate with yourself. Have compassion for yourself. Start with giving yourself a break. Start with giving yourself a break. Be compassionate with yourself. You know, again, you're walking the right path. Your heart is good. Mm-hmm. Be compassionate with yourself, and it enables us to become more compassionate with others. It enables us to be more understanding of others. Because when we're in that, when I don't have compassion for myself, I'm not having compassion for anybody. You know, and compassion for myself is a lot different than feeling sorry for myself. Right. Because feeling sorry for myself brings me right to the entitlement
right.
that you're talking about. I'm worth this and that, and I'm deserving of this and that, and they didn't give it to me, and now I'm mad. Right. And I'm going to take it out on everybody around me.
Right.
You know, being compassionate with ourselves is like, well, you know, I did the best I could, and I am doing some things well, and I could still have the right to feel good about myself. And you know what? I still have an opportunity to earn the things that I want in the world. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be much better at achieving that if I also approach the people around me with that same sense of, you know, kindness.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to me, you say this going back to our original topic of grief and loss and, you know, loss of the dream or whatever it is, you know, the difference between those two people is one person is grounded in their emotions that the loss took place and the other one is not. You know, the other one is focused on the anger or what they deserve rather than what's really going on is the disappointment that I didn't get what I wanted, what I deserved or whatever, you know, and you know, we get lost. We get lost in all that. And you know, a lot of times the secondary emotion of anger is what we are willing to experience, where the more difficult, emotion of fear is, you know, what we try to avoid.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, by the way, it's a Standing Rock.
Standing Rock.
Standing Rock.
You must feel a lot better now.
I do. I do. I really wish I would have been able to access that.
That's okay.
You know, about a half an hour ago.
Maybe if I chop this thing up a little bit, I can put the Standing Rock. I can make it probably sound good.
Can you please crowbar that in there at the appropriate time? I feel like a heel that
for the right price, I'll take care of it.
I feel like a heel that we were talking about it and then I did not.
Yeah.
I did not.
No, I can see it on your face. It's okay. I'll figure it out. I have plenty of time. So, what's next for you?
You know, I think it's, I'm rolling along. There are good things happening. You know, I'm working in private practice in Boca. I'm working with clients and I'm starting to get the right clients because I'm putting this out there in the universe and people know what I'm up to and what I'm doing well and they know who to refer to me. So I'm hearing from people who, you know, have experienced significant loss and they want me to use my tools to help them. And I'm doing the, you know, the group with Beverly and that actually starts tonight and, working with some of the different agencies locally, to do contract work with them to help develop grief and loss recovery programs with tracks within their, treatment centers mm-hmm. to provide them with an opportunity to do that, to actually do the work myself. To do this work mm-hmm. with these patients in their program who've experienced profound grief and loss in their world, whether it's because of they've lost people to overdose or whether they've just lost mm-hmm. people. So, you know, that's it. It's about putting it out there into the world and doing this work and trying to help people and you know, be able to do this independently to the degree that I'm able.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I mean, when you think about adoption and that loss, I think divorce, I mean, pretty much all of us have some kind of significant loss to some degree. And one of the things you're making me think about is how, you know, our industry has changed so much over the years. When I was first introduced to it, You know, most of the better treatment facilities had the type of programming that you're talking about. I know where I went, you know, there was a grief group. Not as many people were assigned to it. They kind of assessed you on the front end. And if you'd been through certain things, you like if you lost a parent. For me, I went through a bunch of suicides as a teenager. So that was why I ended up in there and, you know, did some really deep work while I was in primary substance abuse treatment, you know, and it's really, really important stuff.
Well, it's one of those things, you know, everybody says they're doing it, you know, or a lot of people will say, you ask any marketer from any treatment center, do you guys do grief and loss work with these people? Like, absolutely, we do this, we do that. But I don't know. I have a lot of questions about that. I think it gets shelved a lot. Because there are the treatments du jour, you know. Yeah. There are the things that are buzzwords, and there are buzzwords to insurance companies. There are things that people pay for, and there are things that you have to put out there to be marketable. It's part of business, and oftentimes that detracts from some of the significant issues that need to be addressed in treatment. Some people are doing it. Some people are not.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. Well, the, you know, one of the last episodes I had was with Joan Marino, who, as you know, Joan,
I do.
She's become like very well versed in adoption over the years. And she's taught me a lot about it that I never knew. And, you know, that's something we see all the time. And most facilities kind of just glaze over it. You know, they don't really dig deep into it. And I think it's a bigger problem that it's kind of misunderstood in our culture in the first place.
So Karen has an adoption group, an adoption specialty group. It's wonderful. The therapist that runs it, her name is Amy Shoemaker. She's like fantastic, really, really neat person and competent clinician. It's a great group. And oftentimes they will give people who are participating in that, they will get the book.
20 things you wish your adopted children wish their adopted parents knew?
No, it's Primal Wound.
Oh, yeah.
Primal Wound. And I've read from it, and it's phenomenal. And I've since recommended it, really prescribed it, to people that I've worked with individually who had the adoption issue. And that's a never fail. That is profoundly impactful, because I think they do a really good job of breaking down what the attachment issue is and how it shows up in later life in a way that people can understand relationally from their own experience.
Right. Well, man, this has been great. Anything else you want to talk about before we wrap this thing up? You want to sing a song or anything like that?
I don't. Probably I'm going to spare everybody that.
If you were going to sing a song, what song would it be?
Whatever it would be, for the benefit of the audience, I would sing it tenor.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, 10 or 11 miles away from here.
Oh, man. I promise that wasn't scripted to whoever's listening.
No, no. Like, it was just...
I teed him up. He had that in the chamber waiting.
I did. It wasn't scripted. It was just bad.
Yeah. Can't argue with that.
It's just a terrible joke.
Well, man, I really appreciate you taking the time to do this, and we got to do it again sometime.
Yeah, it was actually really cool. I enjoyed it. It was definitely a therapeutic conversation and a lot of fun and super cool, and I appreciate you... you know, taking the time and allowing me to participate in this. I think it's really cool.
Absolutely. Thanks. There you go, my friend Eric Bricker. Great guy. So hopefully you enjoyed that conversation. If you did, ask that you please leave a review or a rating at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, whatever platform it is that you use to access this podcast. If you feel like this or any other episode is one who someone you know may like, please share it with them. That would go a long way. You can email the show at thepathtoauthenticity@gmail.com. Follow us on Instagram or like our Facebook page, both at The Path to Authenticity. You can also find the show at patreon.com/thepathtoauthenticity, where by becoming a patron, you can access supplemental content, listen to episodes a little earlier than their official release. Any help you might be willing to contribute will go a long way and be greatly appreciated. So that's it. Hope you keep coming back. Got lots of great episodes coming up. So thanks again. Be nice. Path to Authenticity is powered by Equivox. For digital marketing and web design services, visit equivox.com.